Beers with Chad.
Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here. Another episode of Beers with Chad. Today I am joined by a longtime Juggernaut favorite, Marvelous Max Montana. In today's episode, I talk with Max about, you know, going back to his start as a USA Weightlifting member in 2000. So 20 years with as part of USA Weightlifting, how he's seen the sport grow, as well as, you know, some stories from his time training with Ivan Abajayev in the Bulgarian system, and sort of how he was able to break free of this, you know, traditionalist system where, you know, this is what my coach did, so this is what how I'm going to coach, and how he was able to sort of break away from that idea and develop the way that he coaches the Juggernaut athletes now. So I'm drinking this Stone 24th anniversary double IPA. Cheers. And you can go visit jtsstrength.com for all of our coaching, AI coaching, powerlifting, powerbuilding, super total, weightlifting, jiu-jitsu, strength and conditioning, as well as apparel and books. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast. Leave a five-star review. Help more people find it. Maybe that'll help motivate me to be more consistent in making it and enjoy the episode. Mixture Montana Ada. Very good to see you, my friend.
You too.
You have what, the Golden State cider?
I do. This tasty beverage here.
I feel like Mighty Dry is such a strange flavor, a strange marketing idea for a beverage.
I just see Mighty Ducks when I see Mighty Dry.
Yeah. I have, it's hard to read this upside down, Stone 24th Anniversary Double IPA. Not my favorite one.
The IPAs. But it's like a punch in the mouth.
So I was talking with James and I were talking today about, you know, like, kind of the evolution of weightlifting. When did you first get involved with USAW?
When did my life go downhill? Probably like early 2000s, maybe like 2000, 2001.
Wow.
USAW. I was like a member, but I mean, like, I remember when they had. I think they would like talk about having like 5 or 6,000 members total, maybe like 5, and that included like refs and coaches and like people that, like, you know, were subscribers to the newsletter or whatever. But yeah, it must be almost 20 years now.
20 years. So you were 15?
Yeah. I remember I signed up for USAW card after I bought the Weightlifting Encyclopedia by Arthur Dreschler. Yeah.
How... Describe 2001 USAW Nationals to me.
Nationals. 2003 Junior Nationals was in Florida. I went there. You know, as sad as it is, not like that different. Probably way less people. Like way less people in the audience. But, you know, like, thinking about it, like, the warm-up room was kind of the same. It was, like, kind of, like, well, no, it wasn't the same as, like, now. Now with Rogue, it's way different. But, like, you know, the warm-up room was, like, it was in a ballroom in the back. There's, like, a bunch of platforms kind of almost stacked on top of each other. 100 kids. But I think, looking back on it, it was, there was way more, like, isolation between people and coaches and that kind of thing. Like, or there was just, like, 5 coaches total. Yeah. And so, like, they knew each other, but, like, other people were just kind of floating around there, right?
Like those 5 coaches who'd been the 5 coaches for the previous 30 years.
Yeah, it's probably
did they hate each other, you think?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's a lot of isolation at the meets now as we put up our force field of disdain.
Force field of kindness. That's how we protect ourselves. I think there was... Yeah, I'm sure there's always been rivalry and stuff. I also think back then there was, like, the OTC was a way bigger deal. Mm-hmm. So, like, the OTC was huge. There was a ton of, you know, like, the national team and those top lifters and, you know, some really regarded coaches that were involved in that. And then there's, like, a lot more you know, five or six was other guys.
Like Dragomir and Bob Morris then? Or
Bob Morris was there. I'm guessing Paul Fleschler was probably the coach around then. Because after him, it would have been
I was about to ask, are Paul Fleschler and Artie Dreschler related? They are, but bizarro versions of each other.
Fleschler, Dreschler. Yeah, I think
second cousins, probably.
Yeah, probably. I think I remember I never met Artie Dreschler. I met Artie Dreschler, but I was told stories about him by like the old school. He, you know, my coach knew everybody from back in the day, so
yeah.
I was told all these stories. And apparently, his nickname, this probably dates him. His nickname, which I'm not sure was an insult, was Buggy Whips.
Buggy Whips.
Buggy Whips, because he had
Buggy Whips Dreschler.
Yeah, he had like a 275 for 5 squat, but couldn't press 90 kilos. Maybe couldn't even press 70. So he was like, you know, like he probably like strolled into the gym, you know, in his like knickerbockers and like old hat and like, oh, here comes old Buggy Whips, you know, and everyone in old timey music is laughing at him. But yeah, very interesting. The fast fact for you.
That's just what the closed captioning would say at the bottom of the silent film.
Buggy Whips.
Buggy Whips enters the gym. So his body was like inverse of James Townsend's body.
Yeah, yeah.
Where both of James's limbs are strong, but...
Yeah, very much like... Yeah, that was a thing. But there was a lot of like... From like a training perspective, like those years up till... Up till I would say like 2014, like training knowledge and all that stuff, like some coaches were decent and others were not. And it was almost like a, probably a mystery as to why, right? So like the training, everything was kind of like passed down from like, oh, this is how my, you know, this is how I did it back in the day, right? And when I was lifting, you know, they used to say, oh, Buggy Whips, get your, you know, squat strong. And, you know, so that's what we do. And so it was like, I think that kind of traditional stuff like really was like prevalent. Like you were like, oh, this guy comes from that school of thought, or this guy comes from that school, right? And so it was like, you know, there's probably like factions formed out of those, you know, geographical regions.
Yeah, like the Sharks and the Jets and the so you were, you know, your gang was Bulgarian gang.
Yeah, the train as hard as possible but make no progress gang.
So, but to that idea of like the tradition of it, and, you know, we obviously make jokes and you have your Max Ada Bulgarian Guy theme song and stuff. That was still such a great
little, it really was.
A little ditty there by Dr. Mike.
I'm still waiting for the Chad Wilson Smith music videos to come out. There's some priceless videos, priceless songs Chad has created in, say, the Buffalo Airport that needs to be released, and I'm waiting for this day.
Well,
the world premiere. We'll just leave it at that.
To be another West Side meet, so that it's poignant. But you know, this idea of it going along with like the tradition, and so many people still, I think, are kind of in this traditionalist, this is what my coach did. They have like a lineage, kind
yeah,
of,
yeah.
Which is very like big in jiu-jitsu. Like
yeah.
you have your professor, and so you come, you know, I'm in the Carlos Gracie Jr. lineage, and he gave this person their black belt, and then they gave this person their black belt, and then that person gave my coach their black belt, and that it seemed like this, it still exists, kind of like the coaching tree or whatever, yeah. But people, I think, they hear Max Ada or they hear Bulgarian and they associate those, but what you coach now is couldn't be more different.
Yeah, for
so,
sure.
So, like, take me through that process of breaking away.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, I think the big moment for me was when I realized that there's a distinction between, like, coaching, like coaching philosophy and coaching strategy. And the philosophical stuff, like probably like in jiu-jitsu, where like a school or a family has a philosophy, which kind of encompasses the strategy. It's just like the general how we go about doing things. The strategy is the actual implementation of like training programs and coaching and technique and style. And, you know, the Bulgarian system is a package deal that is a philosophy and a system and a strategy. It's all one thing. So, you know, I didn't grasp that there was those two things. You know, at some point though, like you know, when I was doing that kind of training, I remember at the same time reading, you know, the like translated Russian texts and seeing those books and, you know, having copy of Super Training and all that stuff. So like I was really well aware that there was other stuff people did and they trained very differently. But it was sort of like, how do I look at that from the same perspective of it's like, it's got to be this package deal of like, this is your philosophy, which is like, you know, train super hard and, you know, be tough and do all these things. And then, you know, your strategy, the only way to implement that philosophy is through this strategy of maxing out all the time.
I mean, the Bulgarian one is so interesting and it's beautiful in its simplicity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It is maybe the only training method, principle, system, whatever. You could sum it the whole thing up with one word. Maximum.
Yeah.
It is just maximum. Everything maximum.
So when I, you know, before I met Abhijeev or any of that, I had, you know, I trained exactly like that. Like the transition from training with Goff to Abhijeev was identical.
Even like pre-Goff, weren't you training like that?
Yeah, I just went, that was because I had read about the Bulgarians.
Okay.
Because like, you know, when you like, I imagine today some, you know, the Max Ada of today born in Missouri, you know, like goes online and sees, oh my God, Chinese weightlifting. And they're like, what is this secret?
His name will be Mac, Missouri Mac.
Right, Missouri Mac. So, you know, I did the same, but it wasn't online. It was like looking through a book, right?
Strength and Health.
Yeah. So I, you know, yeah. it was the Dressler book, right?
Uh-huh.
I'd pull, you know, I'd get home and brush off my knickerbockers and, you know, kick the snow off my boots.
After a long day working as a newsie.
Yeah, exactly. you know, anyways, like you look and you're like, oh, like all the best lifters in here are like Bulgarians. And it's talked about with like so much like this mystery, like, you know.
Yeah, to me, weightlifting, my understanding of weightlifting when I was in high school and college and you know, seeing stuff from like Tony Chiarelli and everything, there was this Eastern mysticism.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
To all of it.
Yeah, it's like the flat earther thing, right? It's like... They're not crazy like flat earthers, but it's like the idea that like, oh, there's like some secret info that's being hidden from you, but
this
guess
guy's
what?
In waist deep water doing a clean.
Yeah, this guy's got it. And so, you know, it was like seeing that, like that's where I picked it up from. And that was like, okay, I'll just train like this. And like, you can just train infinite amount. There's no limit, you know, like the idea of like MRV would have been something that you'd be like, fuck, you're just a pussy. Here's a pussy. Watch this. I'm gonna squat 9 more times today, you know. And like, you know, I mean, it'd yes, like you can.
That
but...
moment in Mean Girls when she's like, "The limit does not exist."
The limit does not exist.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Just like this ridiculous sort of like perspective, because at the same time, the philosophy is like this overshadowing thing where it's like you have to just be the toughest person who trains the most. That's the first thing you satisfy, and then whatever system you choose to use to get there, it's going to have to fall into that. So, you know, like seeing it, picking it up from books and picking it up from that, and then that like mysticism of it, you know, was for me like this troubling thing, because like at some point you're like, what's happening and what I is supposed to happen are not the same. And then when I finally met Abhijeev, to kind of circle back to the idea of like how simple it is to sum it up, after spending enough time, like weeks with him, you're like, oh, this, like I could write this whole thing out on a napkin right now. Like that's the system. Like, you know, like, oh, you just like max out plus one pill every day equals big lifts. And you're like, oh, that's it? Like,
so the one pill every day. I mean, I've heard this story many times.
A great story.
For the listeners, I don't think we're, you know, breaking any news here that the Bulgarians enjoyed themselves some drugs.
He told me a great story, just tangentially. He told me a great story about how when they first got, they always called it Bayanabol because it was made in Bulgaria, but they first got it and this is probably like 60s maybe.
Do you think that made it Dianabol to maximum?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
All the pills were 200 milligrams. Yeah. So you know, they get they get the drugs and they start, the team starts taking like one pill like every day they train, like three times a week. And then, because they're all like worried, like they don't know what's going to happen. So then there's one dude, the most Bulgarian dude,
yes,
who's like, fuck that, I'm going to take like 10 every day. And his, Abu Jay was like, his numbers were just like
groundbreaking,
yeah.
Innovator,
yeah.
Pioneer.
If you just take more, look how much stronger you get. And he like hit giant numbers and like everyone was like, oh my God. So that like, you know, they all were just like, fuck it. Like, and they just started feasting on Bianabol every day.
And so
they
became, the 60s or 70s?
That must have been, I don't know the exact timeline when they got it. It probably was closer to the 60s, maybe late 60s.
I had a moment similar to that in a conversation my freshman year of college. We got taken out to dinner by a guy named Hal Connolly, who's the last American to medal in the hammer throw, American male. Gold in Mexico City, whatever, like 54, 56. And he takes Nate,
yeah,
horse Nate,
yeah,
and I out to dinner after a meet at Sac State. We're eating at this Chinese buffet across the track from Sac State. And he starts telling us about, it's like, you know, it's like 1958. And he's like, so my doctor asked me he said, I have this pill, it'll help you get stronger. Do you want it? He's like, yes, of course I do. He's like, and that was Dianabol. And, you know, totally legal, like just given to him by the doctor. And then he starts blowing my mind. He's like, oh, so, you know, Randy Mattson and I call each other up on the phone. These guys who were thought to be from like a golden age of track and field and the pre-drugs and all this stuff. Perry O'Brien, Dallas Long, like, and he's like, yeah, so Randy Mattson called me up and he said, I'm taking four pills. Well, I'm taking six. I think I'm going to start taking eight. And it does seem like it is that bravery.
Yeah, yeah.
Foolhardiness.
Yeah.
Like, you guys are only taking two? I'm going to take four.
Yeah.
Let's see how it goes.
I heard stories from the old time guys that were like the method of dosing was to like take one pill and then add a pill every day and check your stool until you see flex of one of the pills. And then you back off one so you're not wasting any.
Okay.
But this is like a time when they had that stuff like on counters in gyms. You'd walk into a gym and there'd be a bowl of like, you know, D-ball pills, and everyone was taking it.
Just like
Altoids. Yeah, right.
You know, D-ball.
Probably didn't have to pay for it. Maybe it's 5 cents a pill, I don't know, but like...
what a glorious
right?
time.
Think about that. Can you imagine what gyms would be like if everybody was on drugs? Can you imagine if weightlifters now were on drugs?
If there was just fucking candy bowls full of D-ball? So, but the classic Abhijayev...
So Abhijayev's secret of doping, right, was...
Intricate system.
Day one pill. In day two pills. But pill one, finish, gone. But pill two, still inside. Day three pills. Day pill one, pill two, pill three, still inside. Day four, he kept going like all the way to 30 pills. He told me it was
40 pills.
40 pills. It was like he kept going the whole time. Like day 15 pills in, out one. Like, okay, like I get it. I get the gist of it. Yeah.
I see the
how
pattern.
How far is it? Developing. Day 38. Yeah, but that
you
was
sat there for all 40
well,
days.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're enamored with that. Like, oh my God! Like, and he was like.
Because it probably seemed too like he's building to something.
Yeah. Well, what's
this can't just continue.
Day 38. Day 40. Finish. Then day 41. 39 pills. Gone. And then down. You're like, oh, okay. All right. So that's not helpful to me at all, but thank you for telling me the story. Yeah, he was an interesting man. But I mean, like, that was kind of the, like, when you finally have a chance to, like, meet your idol or somebody that you're, you know, putting on a pedestal or whatever, like, or this, like, bigger than life figure. And then you find out that, like, oh, I guess it's, like, really not. It's reductionist to say, oh, it's just, he's just drugs and this. I mean, he did a lot, right? He revolutionized things, you know, because they trained radically different. But it's one of those things where you're just like, oh, okay, like, it is really just like the Occam's razor thing. Like, what are the least assumptions I have to make about this being true? that they have figured out and mastered some way of training, or just take like a whole bucket of D-ball and train really hard, and the guys that die or break, they're gone. He once told us, I remember this so distinctly, he once said to us that there was an A team, a B team, and a C team. And he would say, like, the C team was, like, the guys they, like, experimented on that were, like, well, let's see what happens. We train this way or take this. And he told me about a dude named Jordan Dabirev who was 90 kilos, who had, like, blown his shoulder up so he couldn't even jerk or snatch. All he did was clean and power clean and squat. And he claimed that at 90 kilos, so probably heavier, 93, 95, power clean 230. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, like he said a lot of numbers, and like if you're gonna believe anyone, I mean, he didn't seem like he had a reason to lie about the numbers, being that he'd had guys do them. But like, if that's true, that's like fucking retarded. He might have been like a James guy, right? If James was born in Bulgaria, right, that would have been
old Bulgarian ridiculous. James.
Yeah, but you know, it was like so they had these teams. But this one thing he said that was like so funny to me. He's like, you know, I think it was one of the translator was telling us, like, oh, yeah, the A team, the B team, and the C team. And this is when I first got there. They were talking about it, and he says, you know, no one, you know, there's only two options. Either you train and you adapt, or you train and you die. And the next words he said were, and no one's died from the training. And I was like, why did he add from the training? No one's died from the training. Have people like died? Like, have you killed people? Like, what's?
And I like that he probably wasn't trying to say that as like this. You know, he wasn't making a motivational.
Yeah, no, it was not
Instagram post from that. It was just like a matter of fact of.
Yeah.
You adapt or you die, and no one has died, so we're gonna keep.
Yeah, he just kind of glossed over that like spectrum of like getting injured or being, you know, catastrophic injury, like
near death.
Yeah, yeah. So there was so many crazy stories. He told us a story too about this dude, the first guy to snatch 200 at a world champ. No, first 110 kilo guy snatched 200. And I can't remember his name right now, but he, like, after, you know, cleaning up and not taking drugs for a while, he was, like, couldn't lift, and he couldn't even clean and jerk 200. And so he was, like, gonna jump off the roof. He's, like, went up to the top floor and was, like, ready to kill himself.
Fucked.
Right? I'm just like, that's fucked up. That's crazy.
That is a level of dedication that does not interest me to have.
No. That's I've had some clients that would consider that, like, oh my God, I missed a 78 kilo snatch yesterday, like it's over.
My fans will never they'll never forgive me.
My OnlyFans is gonna plummet now. Maybe that's a little different.
Yeah, I don't know if they're concerned with the weight of the snatch there.
Depends on the fans.
Well, there's a market for everything.
Yeah.
So that was just kind of it, though. Then mm-hmm. It was like seeing that there's not the curtain.
Yeah. So the curtain gets pulled back, and you're like, okay, this is what it is. It's not, you know.
You just see that Oz is a guy back there with like a voice modulator.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. And you're like, okay, so there's got to be something different. And I actually remember a conversation with you I had on the phone where you were asking about Bulgarian training, and you were kind of like, well, what would you do if you're going to give this out as like a program to a lot of people? And I remember saying that, you know, the problem is you've got this strategy, and the strategy is very clearly defined. This is what it's going to be. But how do you turn it from like Bulgarian to like Bulgarian light? It's no longer Bulgarian. Mm-hmm. And then if you're going to make one change, which is like, don't do as much training, then the question comes up, which is, well, Bulgarian training violates this principle, this principle, this principle, etc. Why would you just make a crappy program that violates only a few principles when you could just say, why don't I just change the whole thing altogether and build something that makes sense? And that was that kind of process I went through, where it was like, okay, you know, this system is not working. It's not really super effective. You know, and claiming you're using elements of it is pointless, because the elements you're using are just definable parameters, like you go to 90% or above or heavy lifts, that exists in every program. So like you don't need to stick to the roots of it. You just need to redesign a program. Look at programs that are successful that make sense. All the Soviet stuff, all the Russian training, and every other country that used that system was successful, and the style of programming made a lot of sense from a sustainability standpoint. And
so what would you say then if someone was to claim that they're using elements of the Russian system and elements of the Bulgarian system in conjunction with each other?
I don't even understand what that means, because it's like the things that define them both are contradictory, right? It's the degree to which each principle of training, manifests itself in the program is what defines the program. So if your program is defined only by specificity and overload, and every other principle is basically like, eh, fuck them, right? And the other system is like, it's a measured and managed amount of each principle. How can you combine elements of those? It's just like, it never made sense to me, kind of combining the two. I think it's like maybe a colloquial thing to like explain that you really are doing like a Russian program, but you go really heavy a lot of the time, which again brings up questions of like, well, if you're adding in lots and lots of heavy lifting, how does that impact whatever else is happening? You're going to have to reduce volume in places. You're going to be, the phasic structure is going to be a little bit more, less contrasting. You're going to have like mostly the same kind of training for a long period of time. Variety changes. Like, so it's like,
yeah, if you, I do this system, but I change this foundational element of the system, then you don't do that system.
You're just
saying things.
That was like a big thing for me, was like seeing that, like, okay, there's a better way to do this. At the very least, if your results are the same, it's more sustainable. It's way more, applicable to somebody who's living a normal life and, doing regular stuff than having to squat, five times a day or whatever.
What's the NAP MEV when you're in the Bulgarian system?
So he wanted, his whole thing was like, we snatch for 9 minutes, then you rest for 30, and then you go clean and jerk, same, squat, same. Every single exercise had a 30-minute break in between, 15 to 30. And we would go and watch like TV or go sit there or whatever, move around, talk. And he was like, ideally, you should lay like this with your eyes closed, still and motionless, not sleeping, but as little energy expended as possible. That's what he wanted 80% of your day to be.
So just hibernation.
Yeah, you just basically are almost catatonic.
I remember Tony telling us about, Bulgarian system and stuff at these shot put clinics, and he talked a lot about weightlifting. And I hear him talk about how they took the nap, train three times a day, and they take these naps and everything. And I think that was part of the reason that I avoided going to weightlifting after shot putting, why I went to powerlifting, because my understanding of weightlifting at the time, like 2010, was, I'm not like 12 years old, so it's too late for me to be good.
Yep.
And I was like, you have to train like 10 times a week, and like, I don't have time to do that. And now in hindsight, seeing someone like, Alyssa, who she was training five times a week, right? In five sessions a week in the last months of her best training. If I would have known that I could be successful doing that, and as a 49 kilo female versus 140 kilo male, I probably could have gotten away with four times a week.
Yeah.
That like, so changed my perspective on it.
That's something like, once you understand like just the concept of like maximum recoverable volume, starts to paint, it frames the concept, the idea of like training multiple times a day so differently. Because, initially you think training twice a day means you're going to get that much better. You have to, you can increase the volume and do so much more training, and that's what makes you better. But I would be surprised if somebody was to research it and actually prove that training multiple times a day was significantly more effective than a single time a day. outside of you know, taking the same amount of volume and just breaking it up into two sessions versus having more volume attributed to two sessions. Because ultimately, if you have X amount of sets and reps that equals mm-hmm. your MRV, like, you're not going to do more of that because you're adding a second time in the day. And it, you know, there's definite trade-offs. That was one thing that for me, like the multi-day, multi-workout things just were never like as profound as you expect the results to be, right? Like, oh, we'll train twice a day. Like, that's going to be way better. In some cases it is, it helps recovery and can break up the work, but I don't think it's something that would be like first on the list of things I would do to say really improve things. Obviously the first thing is, you know, train within recoverable volumes. And if you're doing that, then break it up however you want. Mm. Right.
So I have this, this text that's from, this is December 28th, 2015
that I posted.
That's what I was, scrolling. This is from between you and I.
This is probably right after that conversation. That phone conversation.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Max, how can people be so anti-volume training? Chad, because they scurred. Max, must be. It's the hardest kind of training, but it has the most amplifying effect on training load. Look at my 35 squat sessions a week. It took 10 years to get to 600 pounds.
Yeah.
Using only high intensity and no volume. Chad, very good point. Chad, also your legs are tiny.
Yeah, that's true.
Max, I could have done that in 3 years with a smarter program and half the frequency.
Yeah.
Oh, well, so true. I think that was to your legs being tiny.
Yeah.
Small knee sleeves, right?
I wear Joanne's knee sleeves.
Remarkable.
My wife. And they're tight on her. They fit me fine. I don't even know. I feel like, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, though, right? Where it's like, and, you know, maybe there's different people. Maybe I have just the shittiest genetics for lifting, but, like, the idea that, like, if you really...
What if you do? How fucking sad would people on the internet be if there was some way to test shittiest genetics?
You've got shit genetics, bud. Yeah. Like, they do, like, one of the 23andMe, and instead of telling me where I'm from, it tells me I'm fucking terrible at lifting. You'd probably be really bad at squatting, too.
Yeah, you know, I did it 23andMe, and one of the things it does is you're, like, predisposition to success in speed power sports.
Okay.
Which it has three categories of. I was the lowest category.
Oh, interesting.
The worst category in that.
Interesting.
And I was also predisposed to being of average weight. Wrong on both accounts. I'm not sure which. I feel like they're more wrong at the second one.
Oh my god!
But I was good at speed power sports as well. But I was really good.
I wonder how they get the average weight thing. Because I would think it would be like a body mass index or something. They would be like average weight. Because what if you're giant like you? What did it say about head size?
That was not.
They can't even predict that.
Yeah.
That's an anomaly.
But so to that effect, you spend 10 years, 13 years, right, doing that kind of training.
Yep. I could have had a college degree.
Several. Many people who go to college for 13 years are called doctors. Several.
I can never quite get my doctorate in squatting.
What is the time that you look back on of your Bulgarian training time? If you look back at it now, that you were just like, God, this was fucking insane.
I think I can think of a couple events. One, thinking back on how I let like an overarching philosophy of like the Bulgarians are the toughest people and that's how you need to train. I had a hernia surgery in like an inguinal hernia. And I front squatted 200 kilos 4 days after the surgery because I was like, you gotta keep training your legs, even though my shoulders were so fucked up I couldn't snatch. Another event too, after I dislocated my wrist, after I dislocated the bone in my wrist, I started lifting again. Like, I was just like, well, I gotta train again. You just gotta do it, even though it's like a grapefruit. And I snatched. Like, the first day I did the bar, and I was like, okay, I can do this. Then I did, like, 60 the next day, then 110 the next day, then 130, like, a couple days after that. And I remember doing that and, like, feeling this weird, like, pain here, and I'm like, this isn't normal. This isn't right.
You just figured it was weakness leaving your body?
Yeah, exactly. That wrist is going to be strong now. A strong hand. But like that kind of philosophy, like you're thinking like, man, what the fuck was I doing back then? Like thinking that like you have to train super hard to do it. And then obviously the other one, like going in and training with Abhijayev, where I got to training with him and I was front squatting at least 220. And there was a day where I literally like, I couldn't do a 70 kilo squat. It wasn't like I didn't want to do it. It was like my body was just like, I went, picked up out of the rack, and everything in my brain and body was just like, this isn't going to happen.
It's like your body
didn't feel heavy.
It like refused.
Yeah, it just was like, nah, we're done. And I missed it. I like sat down and then just dumped it. I was just like, like 2 days later, I front squatted a PR. But it was like that moment of like, what? Like, this cannot possibly be a way to train.
It was Thanksgiving. Was
it? It was Thanksgiving. Yeah, yeah, yes. Yeah. Because I went to Thanksgiving, we took a day off, and then came back and squatted up.
Yeah, you had the super compensatory effects of Thanksgiving.
Yeah, yeah.
Anabolic mashed potatoes.
Turkey. It was the turkey that day was the equivalent of like 300 milligrams of D-ball. But another time too.
Abhijayev was probably injecting those turkeys.
He was incapable of cooking. He once put a sock in the microwave, and it burned. It just smoked up the whole house. He once left the stove on.
What was his goal with the sock in the microwave?
I don't know what he was doing. He would do weird stuff.
He was like, my feet are cold. I want to warm my socks.
He never slept in his bed. He slept in the closet because he was afraid of the KGB. That's true. He never slept in his bed one time.
That he thought the KGB was going to come to America and get him because he was like a traitor.
He wanted his secrets.
He was Russian.
He may have been, born in Russia, but okay.
So it was that
I don't think he was
Bulgaria. The country of Bulgaria was training one way.
Yeah.
And then he got this idea to train another way.
So he told me when he became the head coach, the guy who was head coach before him was also the best lifter in the country. And he had done a 90 kilo clean and jerk. And so he coached.
Abhijayev had done 90
kilo. No. The best lifter in the country.
Okay.
This is, probably like, 50s, early 50s, 60s, or early late 40s, right? So Europe is recovering from the war, but he coached Alex Krychev, which was his, like, first big lifter, and Alex was incredible, right? I think he may have pressed, 190, maybe 200 kilos. Like, he was ridiculous, and he was a junior, and so he had this like little bit of reputation. So they're like, okay, he's like, well, I can be the coach. I'll just take over and do this. And so they kind of had this thing. He ends up becoming the coach. And then he was, Russia was disseminating these piecemeal programs to everybody. Like, there's how you train. People were doing it. And, they might change something here and there. But he was like, I'm going to do this something different. Right. And he's like, a bucket of pills? No. But anyway, so they were like, one the first day. So they trained differently, and he had this different
one
system.
Bucket.
Yeah, one bucket a day. And, he had great results with it and then started bringing everybody up. And then suddenly he became like this figure of like, holy shit, this guy's doing tons. He would say stuff like when he was starting to train people like every day, that was weird. People had never trained. They would they'd be like, oh, there's a weightlifting meet like September. I'll start training in July. Like, or I'll start training in August. Like, they would train for 2 months before meet, and then they would do nothing for the rest of the year. So he was radical in the idea that, like, we're going to train, every day. We're going to train really hard. I think everyone kind of caught on after that, and everyone caught on and started doing it. But he was, like, kind of revolutionary in that, like, we're going to train super fucking hard and take a lot of pills.
So Abhijayev obviously has his mark impression that he's made, his legacy.
Mm-hmm.
What would you hope that, when two young rapscallions are doing a podcast, in the year 2050, and they're like, oh, that Max Ada guy back in the day, what do you hope that they is your legacy as a weightlifting coach?
Oh, that's a tough one. I would hope that the legacy is something that's like, be a little bit skeptical of what you're doing all the time and try to refine a process rather than just adopt a, you know, a system or adopt somebody else's recipe, right? Like refine something and make it your own, but, you know, go back to principles. Always be based on something that makes a lot of sense. And Air Monarchs, probably.
Air Monarchs, yes. Air Monarchs. All right. Well, cheers, sir.
Cheers to you. Feet on bar. Feet on floor, hands on bar.
Look for your eyes.
Find your eyes. If you like that video, smash that like button, smash that subscribe button, and murder the notification bell.